Hello and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change, where we explore the ideas that are forming our future reality. My name is Dr. Roslyn Savage. After an environmental epiphany 20 years ago, I left a corporate career to row solo across three oceans, using my adventures to raise environmental awareness. And ever since then, I've been obsessed with how we create a better world. On this show, I talk with scientists, philosophers, economists, and activists about how we create a thriving world for people and planet.
And the thing about regeneration, which is so beautiful about the word, to my way of thinking, is it's innate to us as human beings. That is to say, we do it every day. Our 30 trillion cells do it every nanosecond, but we also do it with our friends, you know, with our family, with, if we have pets, we do it with our pets, we do it with our plants, our garden, with, you know, we are constantly attending to things in our life to ensure that there's more life, that they grow, that they prosper, that they thrive, that they're nurtured. And this is innate to being human beings.
This week's guest is a legend of American environmentalism, Paul Hawken. Paul starts ecological businesses, writes about nature and commerce, and consults with governments and CEOs on climatic, economic, and ecological regeneration. He lives in Cascade Canyon in Northern California, with nuthatches, grey foxes, coyotes, pileated woodpeckers, and a red-shouldered hawk who visits regularly on his field mouse patrol. Paul has written 8 books, is published in 30 languages, and his books are available in over 90 countries. His book Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, debuted as a New York Times bestseller in 2017. He's just completed his latest work, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. Paul has very kindly offered to send a free copy to the first person who can guess his favourite food. Hint, it's a plant. I've known Paul since we met at Mountain Film in Telluride, Colorado in May 2007. It was a real joy to catch up with him on this call to talk about regeneration, apocalypse, fear, joy and courage, behaviour change, climate communication, COP26, male vertebrates, plant intelligence, and being a piss-poor Buddhist. Hello, Paul, and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change.
Good afternoon and good morning.
It's really great to see you again. It's been a few years since we found ourselves on the same side of the pond at the same time.
Yes, it has. And it's lovely that one of the benefits of the COVID outbreak is that we now can connect to each other without pond jumping, without having to, you know, cross oceans to have a meaningful contact, you know, that actually explores. You know, I've been asked to give, you know, plenary talks on Zoom. And I said, no, that's not what Zoom is for. Zoom is for conversations. It's for questions and responses and answers and dialogue. And it works so well that way. I'm really looking forward to having this with you.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it too. So I like to kick off the conversations with asking my guest, what's your favorite quote and why?
I think my favorite quote, at least right now, is Wendell Berry's quote, you know, which is, be joyous though you know all the facts.
Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. You know, I mean, right now, all the facts are the Sixth Assessment and the fact that the Northern Hemisphere is on fire and there's floods and droughts and suffering, which I do not mean to make light of at all. You know, there's a tremendous amount of suffering and the amount of suffering is increasing. And we know the causes. It's not like, whoa, why is this happening? We know exactly what the causes are. We know what caused global warming. We know what we did. We know what we put up there. We know how we put it up there. Greenhouse gases, we know how to take it down, all that sort of stuff. But the fact is, this is where we are. And the question is, do we go into anxiety? Do we go into fear? Do we go into a sense of doom? Do we go into kind of apocalyptic scenarios? You know, do we want to lead our life that way? It's an interesting thing because, you know, you're only here for a short time. So who you want to be while you are here? And to me, what the facts are, in this case, global warming and all the ancillary outcomes and effects and impacts that has, it's really, we're being homeschooled by the planet. It's a teaching. It's like, we're the students, you know, we all live here, you know, we're the inhabitants of the biosphere and the climate and the atmosphere are the same thing. And they're not separate, two different things. And so we can be grateful. We can honor suffering and feel a sense of compassion. We can act out of kindness. We can think of ourselves as human beings who are innately generous as opposed to fear-based and selfish and taking. So this is what the homeschooling is teaching us. And so be joyous though you know all the facts means that, well, let's celebrate life. It doesn't mean that you don't understand what's going on. It means I got it. I have the science, brilliant science. The predictions have been spot on, or actually in a sense not. The things are happening faster than the predictions were originally put forth by the IPCC. And I'm ready to go. What to do? Here's my life. And how am I going to spend it? With whom? In what way? So that quote just tells me, people say to me sometimes, well, you know, are you optimistic? I said, no. And so you're pessimistic? I said, no. I said, are you hopeful? I said, I'm not even remotely interested in hope, because hope is the pretty mask of fear. And what we need to be now is fearful and courageous. Courageous is courage, is heart, heartful, full of heart. And the rest of it is simply a dalliance from my point of view, both optimism and hopefulness. I'm not interested.
So courage and joy are where it's at.
Yeah, and fearlessness. I was talking to somebody about, you know, they were going through their anxiety and so forth and all the different things they were worrying about. And then I said, yeah, I won't repeat the whole dialogue, but, you know, I'm worried about this and then about food, about famine, about migration, about my family, about and so forth. I said, but what are you really, really worried about? You know, and finally the person said, I'm worried they're going to die. I said, great, because I can tell you absolutely that's true. So now you don't have to. You don't have to worry about it anymore.
Death and taxes. Yeah, the two absolutely certain things in life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so put it away. Yeah, you're going to die. I don't know how. No one knows when. It could be tomorrow. It could be, you know, 30 years from now, but you're going to die. So put that aside, because that is not something you want to basically overlight and steer your life by, that fear of death.
Yeah, and something I'm looking forward to coming back to later is sort of belief systems, because that feels like such a really important topic. But before we get to that, one of the things that I really admire about you, Paul, is the way that you combine science and calls to action to civil society, especially in your book, Blessed Unrest, spirituality and storytelling. And it feels like your latest book, so we're having this conversation now in August 2021. And so it's next month that your new book, Regeneration, comes out. And for the people who are watching this on YouTube, I'm holding up a very gorgeous book right now, which would grace any coffee table. It has the most beautiful pictures in it. And it was a thrill for me to be able to show Paul his book for the first time, because he hasn't received his copy yet. And this is a really data-driven document, in a way, that's the companion to your book from a few years ago, Drawdown. And in these two books, you've done a huge amount of research with your team to come up with the top solutions to the climate crisis, to tell some really beautiful stories and present inspiring images of this world that we are trying to protect. So these different ways that change happens, like science, storytelling, spirituality, what's your sense of what's our biggest leverage point for change in the world? Does it start with any one of those three, or how do we make change happen?
It always starts with story. It always starts with narrative. It has since we first walked upright as Homo sapiens, or whatever we were then, before then. I think that on the science, on the data side, what I tell my staff, and it's like the science and getting it right and the data is like a floor. That's the floor. We're building a floor. What we want to do on the floor is dance. You can't dance if you don't have a good floor, rocks and boulders.
So this is true.
Yeah. So the purpose of the book isn't science so much, is to make sure that whoever reads it, that it has a very strong foundation in fact and in data. And so somebody can't, a scientist, for example, or somebody can't say, oh, well, you know, you dropped a decimal point, or you, you know, egg the pudding here or whatever, you know. So we pay attention to the science, but science does not change people. Data does not change people. Numbers do not change behavior. Acronyms do not change behavior. Fear does not change behavior. Threat does not change, you know, fear of the future does not change people's behavior. Threat, existential threat. I mean, shaming, blaming, guilt, you can just keep going, you know. This is really what the climate communication has been about, you know, for decades, frankly. And it doesn't work. It's not that it isn't true factually. It's just in terms of human beings, we don't respond that way. Scientists may respond to scientists that way, but 98 to 99% of people on the planet today are not engaged around the climate crisis. We could say, well, you know, they're pikers, they're slackers, they're, you know, we could blame them, point our fingers at them. We shouldn't at all. We have to understand, well, why is that true? Why, how could that be that the greatest crisis civilization has ever faced and may ever face in the future is basically something that people are not involved with? And when I say not involved, I mean the, you can, whatever percent you can guess at, no one really knows, the 40, 50, 60, 70% of the people in the world who really understand basically the basic mechanism, or at least believe that global warming is anthropogenically caused and so forth, as opposed to just extreme weather. And those people don't do anything either, by the way. So if they watch a documentary on climate, you know, on Netflix or Richard Attenborough, they think they've done something. They haven't done anything, you know. And so really, you know, the question is, how can we move ourselves, you know, ourselves or like, you know, and our families and our communities, our companies, our churches, our schools, our synagogues, our clubs and so forth. How can we move ourselves to action in a meaningful way? Now, not next year, not someday, and get away from the idea that somehow, well, if I just put cold water in my washing machine or recycle plastic or ride my bike, you know, that I've made, you know, significant contribution. You have not. And it's really important that you do that. And the other side is, well, I hope the conference of the parties in Glasgow, and I hope these corporations, I hope these governments figure it out and, you know, change regulations and subsidies and, you know, all those kind of things that governments can do, the levers they can pull, and that's going to solve it. Neither of them solve it, and both are important. What solves it is in between those two, which is agency, which is networks, which is people coming together, because humanity loves to work together. We like to solve problems together. We learn fastest together as opposed to individuals. And basically, again, like the whole, the Mother Earth and this, you know, this system is saying, well, come on in, the water is fine, you know. To stop seeing the solutions as something that you should do out of guilt or shame or fear.
Yeah, it's one of my critiques of the environmental messaging. And I hate to say this because there are a lot of really amazing people who've been completely dedicated their whole lives to the environmental movement. But I know that if somebody tells me that I'm a bad person for having done whatever, for having got on a plane, my perception is that I'm a good person. So if they're telling me I'm a bad person, then I'm not going to take that very well. You know, it's either not going to resonate with me or I'll shut them down. So seeing the crisis as an invitation, I think, is so much more empowering. And I know that you're very careful about the language that you use around this. So I was actually curious to read the covering note that arrived with the copy of Regeneration. And I'm guessing that you didn't write this. Yeah. I'll just read this one sentence. Regeneration is a call to arms to mobilize against the degradation of our planet in order to safeguard the future. I know that the sort of military terminology is something that you prefer to avoid, because I think you take a much more holistic, inclusive approach, that when we're part of the problem, we can also be part of the solution, that the climate is not something other, the atmosphere is not something other, it's us and we are it. Is that a fair representation?
Yeah, the verso, which is what you read on the back of the book, is something the publisher puts up, you know, and you go, the reason I don't use words like tackle combat, you know, fight, mitigate for that matter, is several reasons. One is, first of all, we hear these terms, you know, we're going to fight climate change, we're going to, you know, combat this, we're going to mitigate it, you know, these are verbs. Verbs are not goals. Nouns are goals. So what's our goal? Is our goal to combat? I don't think so. Second, those terms are military terms or sports terms. And guess who came up with those? You know, our trusty white charismatic male vertebrate scientists, you know, and journalists and people, because they think in those terms. That's fine. There's no problem with that, excepting that that language is basically othering climate and the atmosphere, global warming. And there are people talk about, well, we need to fix it. Interesting two words, a verb and an object, right? Fix, really? It, what is it? What's it? Can somebody tell me what it is? And is it, because as soon as you speak in that kind of lingo and that language, you know, and you think that way, basically you are entirely separating yourself from where you live and from the biosphere and from others and so forth. So it's not so much that, like, I prefer holistic thinking. And what I'm saying is that othering doesn't work. I mean, the Me Too movement came out of women being othered for God knows how long, for by how many cultures and how many ways. Okay. I mean, racism is othering, anti-Semitism is othering. And so the way we've treated atmosphere and the way we've treated the biosphere, the way we have treated our oceans is othering as well, which is like, well, not my problem, or, you know, just put it here, I'll never see it again, all that sort of stuff. But when we get to the idea that somehow climate is, where is it? Find it. I mean, where is the atmosphere? It's in the room and you're breathing it right now. So to think that, you know, which is the way, look at the U.S. and Afghanistan, which is right now, the U.S. is pulling out 20 years of fixing Afghanistan. How'd that go? You know, I mean, and so this idea that we can go in and by force and by technology or by, you know, monetary strength, or in this case, military strength in terms of Afghanistan, or and fix things, this just isn't true. It's not how humans change. It's not how cultures change. And it certainly isn't the way the earth changes. And we have to understand the climate today is perfect. It's perfect. It's responding to what we're doing down here. Nature never makes a mistake. Never. We do. So again, this goes back to this teaching, which is, okay, nature doesn't make a mistake. So what are we doing that isn't in alignment with what we really do understand scientifically, instead of, you know, using parlance or language that makes it a subject-object sentence, you know, which simply isn't true when it comes to nature. The Ashuar people in the Amazon do not have many, many indigenous cultures, but the Ashuar have no word for nature. They don't even understand what you're talking about. That's, you know, how inseparable they don't have a language in which they can understand that kind of separation.
That makes total sense. Yes, because often we talk about nature or the environment as a way of detaching from it. And I remember having this conversation on an airport shuttle in the States once, and the driver asked me why I was in town, and I said I was speaking at some conference about the environment. He was like, oh, I'm not really into all that environment stuff. And I didn't say it because I'm too British and polite, but I really felt like saying, you may not be into the environment, but then, you know, what do you think you live in? What do you think you eat and drink and breathe? So the language really is so powerful there, isn't it? And the way that we've somehow, even language around throwing stuff away, like where is away in a closed loop system like planet Earth? So I'd like to take a quick break now. And then when we come back, I've got one of my special questions for you. Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. Welcome back to my conversation with Paul Hawken, ecological entrepreneur and author of wonderful books like Drawdown and Regeneration. So, Paul, if you were democratically elected king of the world for a day, what would be your first royal decree?
My first and only one would be to ban kingdoms for the next 2,500 years. And no more male vertebrates going around telling the world that what they should do or that they know better than somebody else and so forth. So I would say that you could only have queendoms from that point on and for 2,500 years, which is approximately the time when we've been oppressing, suppressing, and vilifying and subjugating women, maybe longer than that. But just give 2,500 years for women to be in charge.
You're a very enlightened man. I think some women would say we deserve a little bit longer than that.
I would probably agree to 5,000 years. That's cool with me.
But there again, maybe we just work more effectively and efficiently than men, so we can crack on and do it in 2,500.
I think so, yeah.
It is interesting that even now in this day and age, I was part of a campaign last year to try and get more women onto the leadership team for the COP26 that's happening in Glasgow this year that you mentioned earlier, that all of the leadership team was male. And I'm not sure that very many of them were charismatic, to be honest. Being mostly British politicians. But I'm not sure, actually, in all seriousness, I'm not sure that a world run entirely by women would be any better than the one that's being created mostly by men. It feels like what we really want is a balance between, I don't even want to put it in terms of men and women, but more in terms of the masculine and the feminine.
Sure, but I mean, the question at the end of the day is the sensibility. And the fact is that innately, without it getting into stereotypes, you know, women think laterally and socially, and men think hierarchically and up and down. And so what we need is actually the innate sensibility about coming together as opposed to being in charge. And that's the difference between men and women. The quality circles that, you know, came out of really Japan, but they didn't come out of Japan. This idea of quality circles came from Edward Deming. And Deming observed in the United States during World War II, there was munitions factories, and many of the men in the factories had been drafted and were in Europe or in Asia. And so their jobs were replaced by women, you know, that is wives and daughters and aunts and, you know, grandmothers and whomever of the very men that they had left. And what Deming noticed was that the quality of the munitions that were coming out from the women, they were segregated in the factory. The men did over here, the women over there. The men didn't want to work with the women. It was so much better. The women did such a better job. And he couldn't figure out why. Like, well, what do they know? I mean, they're just new to the job. They don't have the experience, you know. And what he noticed was that twice a day, during coffee break or tea break, whatever you want to call it, the women sit in a circle and talk about, well, today I noticed this. Betty, have you seen this? Yeah, I have, you know, Linda. And they would just be sharing about what they could do. If we could change this, what do you think if we did this, what would happen and so forth? There was no hierarchy, and they weren't interested in the hierarchy. They're interested in getting their sons, their husbands, their uncles, their brothers home. And so for them, making munitions that were absolutely not going to blow up in somebody's face was crucial to their sense of being. And the way they did it was innate to being the way women work. And so that's why I say a queendom, because it's just a different way of thinking of our relationships and so forth. And we think of Thatcher and, you know, women leaders and going, well, there's no difference between that and a guy. That's because those kind of political leaders or even corporate leaders, you know, are bathed and schooled in a paradigm and a way of thinking that is basically corrupt and harmful. And so we see a woman can mimic that, okay? But that's not what women's leadership would be about. No way. So I'm not saying women are perfect. No way. They're just women. Men aren't perfect. No one's perfect. They're just human. But for the next 2,500 years, I take that stripe of human as opposed to the masculine.
And it does sometimes feel like that desire to solve problems with a very narrow focus on here's the problem, I'm going to find a solution, has led us into a world that is kind of the sum total of unintended consequences. As we solve one problem, we've created 10 more, and then we try and solve those 10 and end up with 100. And I sometimes feel like I just want to shout, let's just stop. Let's just take a moment, everybody, time out, and pause before we actually take any further actions, because it does feel like at the moment there are so many new scientific discoveries coming out around the incredible intelligence and intricacy of nature. Until a few years ago, I'd never heard of the mycorrhizal network, or the wood wide web, as Suzanne Simard calls it, this communication, very sophisticated communication between trees through their roots and through pheromones and chemicals. We didn't know about intelligence in many animals like the octopus. It feels like there has been this incredible arrogance on our part that we can manipulate the world to our will when we don't even understand it. I wonder how we go about healing the relationship between humans and the world, and healing the world itself, trying to remedy how to regenerate the world, in fact, without generating even more unintended consequences.
Well, by listening and being aware of the world you live in, by being in alignment with biology and by life itself, it's very, very true that, you know, the intelligence of this world is becoming more manifest. You know, Monica Galliano in Italy, obviously Suzanne Simard in British Columbia, in many, many ways. You know, Carl Safina's work on animal intelligence and communication. We're sort of gobsmacked by what we didn't know. And what we didn't really realize is that our intelligence couldn't understand, let's say, there, whatever it is, whether it's a plant or tree or an animal or their intelligence, because it's a different type of intelligence. It's completely different. And so again, the arrogance that our intelligence is the intelligence, you know. And, you know, Monica Galliano, makes a very good point, you know, which is plants have been here a lot longer than us, and they've done very well. And they have 20 senses compared to our 5, and they have all 5 that we have. That is a major figure ground shift, you know, thinking about plants, which is, you know, they're just there, but they're sessile. They don't move. We're mobile. So we have a very different sense of organs and nervous system to move around and capture, take, gather. And plants don't move. And so they have developed a very different sense of sensibility and intelligence about over, you know, 400 million, 500 million years, you know, about how to survive. I mean, so have we. We're survivors. We're talking. And so there is this sort of, I think, a sense of mystery and awe. You know, that's my, this Drawdown Regeneration is part of a trilogy. The next book is about mystery, wonder, and awe. It's about falling in love with this place where we live in. We just don't really fully appreciate it because we haven't been educated to appreciate it, I think, you know. And it's interesting, going back to the gender thing too, because when Suzanne Simard, I mean, she came from a family of forest loggers, you know. I mean, they use mules and things. They would cut a tree and they would drag it out of the forest to a road. I mean, very, very, very careful logging. But so what she discovered, of course, was that when you clear cut and then bulldoze and then even herbicided, and then you planted new Douglas fir trees, they didn't do very well compared to trees in the forest that were replanting themselves. And so her discoveries about plant communication, in this case, the trees, you know, injecting carbon-14 into a tree and then having her students determine how long it took for that carbon-14 to be distributed to other species, other plants and so forth. It was an astonishing discovery. She started to use the word altruism, mother tree, and boy, did she get hammered by her male colleagues. She got hammered, you know, she didn't let go. She kept going and so forth. And now, I mean, she was friggin' right, you know, because what men were seeing is basically forests was a competition, you know, and, you know, every tree is phototropic. So therefore who got the most light was the winner and so forth. And they're looking up at the, you know, that way and thinking that's what's going on instead of seeing it down below, which she did, which is this incredible, I mean, not just the Wood Wide Web, which is what the first was named by the Nature magazine when they published her first piece, but But I mean, the complexity of what's going on there is mind-boggling, and it makes the World Wide Web, the one we have now, look rather simple in comparison.
Yeah, talk about projection and seeing the world as we are rather than as it is, that men saw it as competition and women were like, no, actually, the forest is collaborating here. And I love it that one of the, what do you call them, guest contributors to Regeneration is Richard Powers, who wrote The Overstory, which has a fictional character based on Suzanne Simard, I believe. So continuing on the topic of plants, in both Drawdown and Regeneration, there's quite a strong emphasis on regenerative agriculture and the food industry generally, which is so exciting because that's really something that each of us as individuals can do to support in regeneration. I wonder if you can say more about that.
Well, sure. I mean, agriculture and food together, I mean, those two industries are about 34-35% of global emissions, more than a third. So, I mean, together, they're right up there with transport, you know, planes, shipping, cars, trucks, rail, etc., in terms of their impact in terms of greenhouse gases. I would say, however, that ag and big food, which is really, I'm not sure which was the handmaiden to the other, I mean, symbiotic in a way, but are much more destructive than transport. Transport is about greenhouse gases and the highways and parking lots, you know, not cool. But big ag is basically destroying land everywhere and destroying forests. And the thing is that as Westerners, you know, as Europeans, really, the fact is Europe was having a tough time in the mid-19th century. Farms were not doing well. There was hunger. There was times of crop failure, there both in the UK and Germany and France and so forth. I mean, it was not a time of abundance in terms of food. And that's when 1842, I think, was when the first chemical fertilizer was invented, and people began to think about, well, how to make the land more fertile. But what they were doing, because they were making it so bioavailable, culminating in the Huber-Bosch process in 1912 or something, I forget the exact date, where, you know, synthetic nitrates were made cheaply, that is, affordably. What people saw in their fields, what farmers saw, were like plants that were like taller, bigger, greener, faster. It was like, I mean, who wouldn't want to use whatever that was doing that to their fields, to their plants, to the corn, to the wheat, to the rye, to the barley, to whatever it was that they were growing. And of course, so boom, there you had industrial ag right there, starting in the early 20th century. But what we have to understand when we think about regenerative agriculture is, well, what is it? Well, what is industrial ag? Well, what industrial ag is basically feeding the plant directly. In other words, it's kind of like putting a plant in an IV drip, you know, NPK, you know, and you put it on in a soluble, assimilable, bioavailable form, so the plant immediately can take it up and so forth, and it grows faster, it grows better in the sense of more, not better in terms of health of plant. We'll get back to that. And it's more productive, there's more cobs of corn, you know, there's more sheaves of wheat, etc., and more money, more food. What's wrong with this picture? The problem with that is that the plant is weaker, because it's just got those macronutrients, but it doesn't have all the micronutrients, the phytonutrients, the minerals, you know, that it once had or should have had if it was being farmed correctly. So the plant is weaker, and then pretty soon you need pesticides because insects are attacking it. And what we need to know about nutrition is those bitter tastes, those complex flavors in food, those flavors come from plants protecting themselves from stress. And the best nutritious plants are stress. Sun is a stress. UV is a stress. Lack of water or periodic rainfall is a stress. I mean, the fact is that plants have adapted to stress, and they adapt chemicals or phytochemicals to resist insect, for example, infestation, and to be adapted to that place. And so what happened was that the new plants, the new wheat, the crops, the soy, the corn, and all these sort of things, you know, are not strong plants. You know, they may look big, they may look abundant, but they're not strong. And so then you have weedy competition. So now you have glyphosate. Okay. So now you have herbicides and pesticides in various and sundry forms and so forth. What's happening underneath? The soil is dying because it's not being fed, and or at least not being fed very much. and it's being fed somewhat. But when you feed a plant, the roots are shallow. They don't need to go very far down because they're getting everything they need in the first 6 inches. And so the roots don't go down. So regenerative ag isn't going back to the past, but it's going back to a principle that has been here for 400 million years, which is soil feeds the plants. That's where the nutrients come from soil. It has to come from healthy soil, healthy that's full of nutrients. And that nutrients are brought about by the different amazing organisms, bacteria and virus and protozoa and and fungi and mycelia, et cetera, that are there working in ways that are extraordinary. So regenerative ag is going back to what the planet does, which is making healthy soil. And then that feeds the plant. The plants are more resistant. The regenerative farmers who are at it for a long time don't have any external inputs. You know, they're in-farm fertility. That's like they don't buy chemicals, they don't buy fertilizer, they don't buy minerals, because basically you have the symbiosis between the plant and the roots going down. And, you know, obviously they're photosynthesizing, all plants and trees do. What is that? I mean, they're separating, you know, carbon from the O2, CO2. So we'll take the carbon, you have the O2, we don't need it. And that's oxygen. And then that carbon makes cellulose, it makes sugar, of course, you know, it's carbon-based. And then, but a lot of it goes down in sugar into the roots. And the roots are growing. They need it just to grow and to capture water and nutrients. But the thing that the roots also do is exude. They're called exudates, you know, which is that sugar is exuded from the root hairs. And those sugars feed bacteria. And those bacteria, this, again, symbiosis or mutualism, whatever you want to call it, they're going, thank you. And they make the minerals, the sand, the dirt, the rock that's down there, they break it down enzymatically and make it bioavailable to the plant. And so if we're like, okay, you give me sugar, I'm going to give you minerals. And so you have this incredible relationship, again, which is so complex, it boggles the mind. You know, I mean, I can explain it simply. But, you know, that doesn't even come close to understanding what's going on, no more than explaining the body gives us any idea of what's going on in our 30 trillion cells. It doesn't tell you what's going on because really nobody knows yet. And so when it rains, it can absorb it easily. 10, 20, 30 times more rain can be absorbed on farms that are regeneratively farmed as opposed to farms right next door. Where the water sheets and runs off and takes soil with it and causes erosion. And that means farms in the world become more resilient and adaptive to climate change, right? Which is too much rain, too little rain. I mean, that's what's going to happen. It's volatile, it's disruptive. And so too little rain, those soils now acting as a reservoir. So for too much rain, we'll take it, bring it in, we'll absorb it. It was not going to run off and so forth. And finally, the thing is that those soluble fertilizers, the NPK and so forth, are soluble, easily picked up by the plant, but they're easily picked up by water, and that water sheets off and that goes into our streams and our rivers and creates the dead zones in our oceans. So regenerative agriculture is about restoring health to the soil, but it's also about restoring health to human beings, because our food that we're eating is denatured, it is not nutritious. And yes, it has protein. Yes, it has fat. Yes, it has starch, you know, and yes, it has vitamin this and that and so forth. But compared to food even 50 years ago or more recently, it's apples and oranges.
So to speak. Yeah. And look, there are some amazing stats on that that I don't have off the top of my head about how the vitamins and minerals, as you say, compared with 50 years ago, are just a fraction of what they used to be. And the impacts that's had on human health. So yeah, regenerating the soil regenerates us as well. And speaking of food, Paul has very kindly offered to send a copy of his new book, Regeneration, to anybody who can name his favourite food with the hint that it's a plant. And I don't know the answer to this, so I'm not open to bribes, or I might be, but I still wouldn't be able to tell you the answer. So thank you very much for that, Paul. And I hope that one day I get to find out the answer to that. So you were saying just then that a plant being stressed by the normal things that happen to it in nature actually makes it stronger. So I want to ask you what might be a bit of a mischievous question here. by any metric, you've had a very successful life so far. And by the way, I'm really excited to hear that there's another book in the trilogy. I'm going to come back to that later on. You've written many books, five of which have been national bestsellers. You founded a number of ethical, very successful businesses. You've spoken at conferences all over the world and been an advisor to CEOs and presidents. Have you ever failed at anything? And if so, did that stress make you stronger? What's been your, I suppose the question is, what's been your biggest learning experience from things not going the way that you thought success was going to look?
Oh my goodness, have I ever failed? I fail every day. I've failed all my life. I've made mistakes, which I regret. I've made mistakes, which I like walking into something. And like, it's not that I didn't deliberately do it. It was a mistake. I feel like one of the things by the emphasizing success is that we, in a sense, occlude or cover up the fact that really any achievement that people are able to accomplish comes from doing something that for them is unreasonable. That is to say, difficult, hard. And if it's not, why would you do it? And it wouldn't be success if you could just do it with a snap of a finger. And so anytime you do that, you're going to make mistakes, because mistakes is how we learn. It's vital, vital that you actually accept the fact that you're going to make mistakes. And they're bummers. Don't get me wrong. It's not like, oh yeah, I made a mistake. That's great. No, I mean, they can be difficult. They can be stressful. They can be economically threatening. You know, if you're in business, I mean, there's many ways in which they manifest themselves. They really are mistakes. But the thing about stress, and they cause stress, is that stress is a signal to do something. That's what stress is. Stress is not something to have day after day after day, night after night, saying, oh, I'm so stressed, I'm so stressed. For sure, what is it telling you? It's always, that's really what stress is about. Again, it's your whole being saying, you know, this isn't really working for me. And so it's an opening, you know, the stress or the mistake is an opening. Each of them is opening. So to me, I see my life. I'm a six on the Enneagram. I see myself. I see problems. I don't see success at all. You know, I see, oh my God, I should have done better. I could have done that. I see myself probably in a way that's the opposite of the way you see me. But I do feel that right now, collectively, you know, we have global warming, the climate crisis, however you want to describe it. And so when I did Drawdown, what I was naming the goal, which is to reverse global warming, Drawdown means that first time on a year-to-year basis where greenhouse gases peak and then go down that year, and then down the next year, and down the next year. And, you know, people said, well, you know, that's kind of an unrealistic goal. And I said, I hope so. Because unreasonable goals, I mean, come on, you rode across the friggin' Atlantic. You know, that's like a really, really unreasonable goal, you know.
I'm Pacific and Indian.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I mean, I was thinking of the first one.
They were all pretty unreasonable. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so that was your first one, you know, and that's where you started, you know, which is like, and I mean, I don't know what your friend said, but I don't think they said, good idea, good thinking, go for it, girl. I don't think anybody said that, you know. It's the same thing. Unreasonable goal, basically. Well, let's talk about reasonable ones. Reasonable ones, they're reasonable because you know how to do them. Where's the learning in that? Where's the curiosity in that? Where's the breakthrough in reasonable goals? There is none. So unreasonable goals are a forcing function, you know, and a forcing function is basically like, I don't know how to do that. What does that mean? What does that entail? What will I need in this case, you know, and you, we don't have the tools. We don't have the technique. We don't have the practices. We don't have the understanding and so forth. Well, how can I? So you're always thinking about things in that way. And that is what is called creativity. It's called breakthrough. It's called innovation. So it comes from having those kind of goals in which you're going to be peppered with mistakes. Like you're going to go down little cul-de-sacs. Or you didn't know that the cul-de-sac and that road doesn't go anywhere. And go back, try this. That didn't work. And try this. You just keep doing it and keep doing it and so forth. Because the unreasonable goal, whatever it is for you, is actually what is holding your being and your heart and what it is that you're there for. And so in the end of the day, the success belongs to other people. Actually, it doesn't belong to you. I mean, people say, oh, you did it, or this is great, or I buy your product, or I bought your book. But that is not your success. Your success started earlier, and that earlier success is committed and devoted to accomplishing an unreasonable goal. That is human success.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I think it's a George Bernard Shaw quote that the reasonable man conforms himself to the world. The unreasonable man tries to conform the world to himself. Therefore, the future belongs to the unreasonable man. And I know that might not sound great in the context of climate change. maybe we've done a little bit too much of trying to conform the world to our will. But the point that I think George Bernard Shaw was trying to make was it is that very unreasonableness, the unreasonableness and the audacity of having these massive goals that actually unleashes that potential that we didn't even know that we had. You know, supposing I sat on my sofa saying, well, I want to be braver, I want more courage. I could have sat on the sofa for a very, very long time and it wouldn't have shown up. I had to put myself in a little rowboat and get out there onto a big scary ocean in order to find out what I was capable of. And so in a way, I feel like that's bringing us back to the subject of the gift in our current challenges. But first, we're just going to take a quick break. Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. Welcome back to my conversation with Paul Hawken, ecological entrepreneur and author of wonderful books like Drawdown and Regeneration. So, Paul, another one of my regular questions. When was the last time that you did something for the first time? And what was it? And maybe also, how did it go?
That's such an interesting question because you're asking that question to a Buddhist. And so the answer is every single moment of every day. It's like, because if you answer it differently, what you're thinking is that things are the same, and this is different. Nothing's the same ever. Nothing repeats itself.
You never step right in the same river twice.
No. And even in the same river, you don't step twice in the same place, in the same water and so forth. So everything is the first time. And so doing this podcast with you is the last time I did something for the first time is right now.
Great answer. I was listening to a previous podcast that you did where you described yourself as a piss poor Buddhist, but, which paradoxically seems like a very Buddhistly self-effacing thing to say. And I also wondered if you were comparing yourself with your good friend Jack Kornfeld. And frankly, I think we're all piss poor Buddhists compared with him.
Yeah, well, he's on my board and he's a teacher. And it's interesting that when I was writing, researching, creating Regeneration, the book, I'd wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning, and part of the reason I wake up is because when you research the subject of climate, not just climate, really, so many areas of how we're losing our living systems, you know, our oceans, you know, our forests, our creatures, our animals, our insects, you know, our soil health, you know, our nutrition, our children. I mean, it goes on and on. A lot of what we research is about change, and that change is almost always about loss. And those feeds come in the morning, the RSS feeds and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, usually I would spend 2 hours with them, you know, sort of digesting, and, you know, sometimes keeping, sorting, you know, placing it into different categories and so forth. At night, I'd wake up at 4 in the morning and I'd be just freaked out sometimes, like, you know, just like inhale, and then I wouldn't go back to sleep. a level of sort of, you know, cortisol was achieved, you know, by my thoughts, you know. And so I would turn on a podcast by Jack Kornfield. So there's 131 of them today. I know them. I've listened to every one of them more than twice. I can finish his sentences. I know his jokes. It's about a kind of a quality of that he has, that of making connections, you know, not disconnecting, you know, self and other, and self to self for that matter. And the fundamental cause of global warming is these profound disconnections we have with each other, to each other, and the profound disconnection we have to nature, and the profound disconnections that we have created within nature, habitat fragmentation and deforestation and acidification, and overfishing of the oceans, the death of the coral reefs and so forth. You know, we're breaking nature into pieces and so forth. You know, all these disconnections, you can look at regeneration and basically regeneration knitting together those broken strands, you know, and the way you heal a system is to connect more of it to itself. And so if you go back to Buddhism, that's an immune system, an ecosystem, social system, any system, if you want to heal it, connect more of it to itself. But that is what meditation is. Meditation is connecting more of you to yourself. And it's hard, you know, because you sit there and, like, you know, these different levels of thoughts and, you know, they call it monkey mind, but, you know, come up and they're like, the thoughts that are suppressed, you know, that you don't want to deal with. You're busy, stay busy, watch TV, you know, whatever. And when you're meditating, there is nothing else but, you know, your mind, which is not controllable, no matter what anybody says. It's out of control. But then you get in touch with those thoughts and your experiences and your regrets, you know, and eventually, you know, it comes to a sense of feeling, like, what is that feeling? And Jack calls it the awakened heart. And it's a beautiful, beautiful phrase. He doesn't really, he's not a big fan of enlightenment, that word, that term. He thinks it's a bad translation in any case, you know. But he talks about a heart that's become awake to the world and so forth. And so regeneration is becoming awake to the world in all its manifestations, you know. And the thing about regeneration, which is so beautiful about the word, to my way of thinking, is it's innate to us as human beings. That is to say, we do it every day. Our 30 trillion cells do it every nanosecond, but we also do it with our friends, you know, with our family, with, if we have pets, we do it with our pets, we do it with our plants, our garden, with, you know, we are constantly attending to things in our life to ensure that there's more life, that they grow, that they prosper, that they thrive, that they're nurtured. And this is innate to being a human being. So the paradigm of combating, fighting, tackling, you know, mitigating climate change is like, really? You think that's going to work? It's like, it's not going to work because people don't think that way. They don't act that way. But regeneration is something we already do. So if we can, in a sense, what the book's trying to do is trying to enlarge that sense of the scope and the possibility of what's possible, to put life at the center of every act and decision and restore life as we know it in whatever way we can with whomever we wish to or wants to work with us and so forth. And if we do that, and if enough of us do that, we reverse global warming. There's no other way to do it. And we're not going to, it's not a science problem. It's a human problem. We're not going to fix it with technology. We're not going to fix our bad technologies with new technologies. This is not going to work. We need renewable energy, of course. I'm not decrying that. I'm just saying is that we have to get out of the Bill Gatesian view of the world, you know, and go back to the view of the world that is, you know, compassionate and grateful to Bill Gates, but I'm just saying is a much bigger vision of what a human being is.
Beautifully said. And as you're speaking, I'm weaving together some threads from our conversation. And if I could take this in a slightly metaphysical kind of direction, I've been reminded of this story that Cristiana Figueres tells. Cristiana being, you could say, one of the chief architects of the Paris Agreement at COP21 in 2015. And she was telling the story about all of the blaming and the shaming that was going on between the different countries, saying, well, you've emitted more, well, you emitted first. And as a good Buddhist, she thought, how am I showing up here? And she realized that she was still holding a lot of blame towards her ex-husband. And so she really did this work on herself so that she wasn't in this blaming mindset anymore. And the way that she put it, this was in a conversation at the Royal Society of the Arts in London. She credits some of the success of the Paris COP to the inner work that she'd done. She's not saying, the way she puts it is, I'm not saying it's connected, but I'm not saying it's not connected. So it's this idea of being the change that we want to see in the world. And it connects back to what we were saying earlier about we project onto nature what we are on the inside. If we're competitive, then we compete with nature. Yeah. If we're collaborative, we collaborate with nature. And I'm wondering if there's something here about self-love and self-acceptance being almost a prerequisite for love of nature. Love of the non-human parts of nature. I'll reframe that. If we have to regenerate our own sense of integrity and self-love before we can be effective agents of regeneration in the world. Does that make any sense?
Oh, that makes total sense. I mean, how can you care for other if you don't, if you hate yourself? And a lot of people do. They feel they do. They don't really, but they think they do, hate themselves, and they act it out. I would say that it's more interesting than that, because it's kind of binary, you know, you got to fix that first and then you can go fix something else. What I say in the book is that beliefs do not change people's actions. And I don't say it. Andrew Huberman says it, a neuroscientist at Stanford. Some really breakthrough research that he's done about human behavior. Actions change our beliefs.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like there's a little observer in my head that when I set out on my first ocean, the little observer was freaking out. It was going, what the hell do you think you're doing? You're not an adventurer. But I carried on carrying on. And eventually the little observer went, oh, okay, maybe you are a bit of an adventurer then, because you seem to be having this big adventure. And it changed my self-concept, my belief about who I was. So that absolutely resonates with me.
Well, not only that, action changes other people's beliefs. See, we cannot change other people's beliefs. We can barely change our own, you know. I mean, you can't change other people's minds. We have enough trouble changing. So when it comes to climate and the world we live in right now, full of the misery and the suffering, loss of women, of children, of indigenous people, of cultures, of places that we're seeing right now in Afghanistan and so forth, just the immiseration of the world is increasing almost every day. And it's painful. And to see it, to feel it, to read, it's almost more than one human being can take in. But at the same time, what we need to do is not dwell there, take it in. That's different than dwelling, and act. Just act. Do whatever you can and act and continue to act. And that changes you more profoundly than any book, any, with all due respect to you and I right now, any podcast. You said the love of self. That is the love of self, is to act and to have faith that takes you to where a better, newer life for within oneself, you know, and for others as well. Regeneration, the last part of it is called action and connection, is profoundly about action. It's not about another book about all the solutions and, you know, as a per se, you know, is the real delivery or the real reward of the book actually is the website and not the book. And the book is a neurotransmitter. It's like, come on in, the water's fine, you know, and read about it. And it's fun to read and you probably learn a lot. And there's many voices in there. And the Monte Nonquino, Hindu Ibrahim, you know, Carl Safina, Isabella Tree, you know, up there in the Nepa State in Sussex. And those voices are such beautiful, you know, ways of seeing and thinking the world, you know, which is shared in the book. But the purpose of the book is to be effective and to act in such a way that brings you to life. Because regeneration isn't about bringing the world to life only, it's about bringing yourself to life. Every one of them, right now, what I noticed, and you couldn't help but notice it because it came up again and again on Drawdown, everywhere I went, people said, what should I do? Or what to do? And really, right now, if you go and try to find out how to do these solutions that are in regeneration and Drawdown, there's no place you can find out how to do it. It's so interesting. And so that's what the website has. And we're not finished with it yet. The book's not finished. I mean, the book's not out yet either. We're working as hard as we can, but it shows you all the things you can do with different levels of agency. This is what you can do as an individual, okay? You shouldn't think of yourself as an individual, really, because you're not. No such thing exists. But if you do, these are the things you can do. This is what you can do as a family, as a neighborhood, as a community, as a club, as a church, as a synagogue, as a temple, as a school, as a city, as a company, as a nonprofit, etc. All these different levels of agency that we have, we're all those things, not maybe every single one of them, but we're many, many people. And we're those people because we're with others, you know. And the agency you can have, this podcast is your one of your agencies. This is God's seventh agency. Okay. So that's what you've created. That's what you've chosen. All right. Everybody has agency. And so when you start to think of that way, these are all things you can do in different levels of agency. These are the bad actors. These are the ones that are causing the problem. If there are challenges, if there's solutions, these are the good actors. These are the NGOs that are kicking butt and will help you, you know. These are the First Nations that are also trying to make sure that the boreal forest is saved, or this is what you can do in terms of food, in terms of, you know, acquisition or, you know, buying or, you know, connecting yourself to farmers and people who are producing really ancient ingredients on healthy soil. You know, these are the videos, these are the books, these are the articles, these, I mean, it goes on, and all by subject. And so you want to do some here. Here's the world's menu. It's not our menu. We're not telling you what to do. This is what the world offers if you want to do that. And what we're saying is, don't try to save the world. That's just, you can't do it anyway. It's a burden, make you feel guilty every night because you didn't do it and you never will. Choose what lights you up. What, where you go, man, I love that. Or I always used to, or I want to know more about that. Or, wow, I had no idea that that even existed. I want to, you know, get involved or whatever. That's what you should go to and choose. And that is the regeneration of the world.
Love it. Yes, absolutely. Because it doesn't have to be about wearing a hair shirt and making sacrifices. It's so important. It's back to your favorite quote about the joy. We have to find the joy in doing what we're doing. Thank you for being so inspiring. Paul, just before we turn the tables, could I just ask you to, I know you haven't even fully birthed this book yet, but can you just give us a little teaser of what the third book in the trilogy is going to be about? You mentioned awe and wonder. Can you say any more?
Yes. And in the research, both for Drawdown and for Regeneration, you go down, I wouldn't call them rabbit holes, but you go into tunnels of thinking and knowledge and science, you know, which is just so fascinating and like sort of mind bending, really. Like George Haskell did a beautiful book where he studied a square yard, I think a foot of yard, I forget, in Tennessee forest for a year. He went there every day and studied what was going on in that square. It's so amazing. But anyway, the book is tentatively called Carbon. And, you know, as a friend of mine once said, carbon is the element that holds hands and collaborates. And it's really about falling in love, you know, like, and just an invitation, really. All books are invitations that I write. But it's an invitation to fall in love with, you know, life itself. And to tell stories, you know, stories about when, you know, bees land on flowers, you know, because they leave a little UV footprint, you know, it can be seen. It's not a UV footprint, but it can be seen by other bees who actually can see UV light. And then they say, oh, somebody's just been there, I won't go there. And, you know, so in a way, they're working in this really sophisticated way to cover the blossoms, you know, and get all the nectar, but not too much. And it goes back to the beginning of the book, you know, I talk about bees themselves, you know, and I mean, if you read that part, you know, but when, you know, these drones go out, they're looking for sources of nectar and they find it, you know, like a tree or a bush or whatever it is that's blossoming, you know, in the wild or in a garden or in a farm, they'll come back to the beehive and they do a dance. It's called the waggle. They do a waggle dance and the waggle dance tells the other bees who are going out exactly where to go, which direction, how far away it is, and very precise instructions. And then boom, the bees go there and get the honey. And so in a way, what we need to do is all learn to do our waggle dances about how to find the joy and the beauty of this world. And it's restoration, rejuvenation, renewal, and regeneration, you know. And so I hope the book is a bit of a waggle dance.
Gorgeous. I can't wait. So just to finish off with then, this part of the show is the moment for you to turn the tables on me. Is there anything that you wanted to ask me, Paul?
Yes, I was. What was the most mystical experience you had in the middle of any of the oceans? Or it couldn't be in the middle, it could be somewhere on the ocean.
Actually, it was in the middle. That's a gorgeous question. Thank you. I did have a cosmic moment. Out of 520 days and nights on the ocean, I had one cosmic moment, but it was worth it. It was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and it was nighttime and I was in the doldrums, so it was dead calm, which was very rare on any of the oceans. Normally the boat's tipping around and everything's splashy and wet, but it was calm and quiet and it was really hot in the cabin, so I came out onto the tiny little deck of my boat and tried to find a little space between the runners of my rowing seat and just looked up at the Milky Way. And you could just imagine what the stars were like so far away from light pollution. And I'm looking up at all of these gazillions of stars and imagining all of the planets going around them and the moons going around the planets, and sort of wondered if there might be a little woman in a rowboat on any of those other worlds. And I had this moment of feeling so utterly insignificant, as tiny and as humble as a mote of dust, but at the same time part of all of that, part of the cosmos. I was nothing and I was everything at the same time. Completely drug-free. It was a gorgeous moment. And it's left me with real curiosity about the nature of reality. And I think we're more than we've been told. We're not just this sack of meat. As an isolated individual, we really, I believe, are part of everything.
That's beautiful. That's great. I've always wondered, because I have been out on the ocean on a boat, a catamaran, you know, far away from land, you know, where you could see star rise on the horizon, you know, not like looking up at the stars. Yeah, for sure. But I mean, you could see star rise. In fact, it was in Hawaii, and it's how the Pacific mariners really used to navigate latitude, was the rise of certain stars, Hokulea, and I forget the name of the other star right now. But the point being is that differential and when and which rose first and which and how much more was a way of navigating. But so to be in that calmness and that beauty and no lights on the catamaran, it's canoe they call it there, but the canoe or externally, and the only lights being from the stars. It's just absolutely mind-bending, you know, and you do realize, for me, I mean, I didn't have your experience, you know, the same way at all, but it is astonishing. It's an astonishing moment to me.
Awe-inspiring.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really enjoyed being with you again, and it's been a while.
Paul, thank you. You've been an amazing guest. Really appreciate your wisdom, your work, your words, and your humour and joy. Thank you so much. It was such a joy for me to spend time with Paul again. He has this wonderful mix of serenity and spark, positivity and practicality, and a determination to make the world a better place, while also a Buddhist Zen-like acceptance of what is. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did.